Of talks and other events organised by Bristol City Council Public Art Department and Arnolfini. These are designed to highlight public art in Bristol and the particular artists and organisations currently involved in developing work for the public realm within the city. This is beginning with four evenings on consecutive Wednesdays devoted to the public art scheme of the new Cabot Circus development in central Bristol and in conjunction with project art consultants Insight Arts. Next week, in a slight alteration to the advertised schedule, we have Ali McCauley from Timorous Beasties, a design company involved in the scheme. Week three is devoted to the work of Neville Gaby, the development's artist in residence, and we finish off on the 22nd of October with the artists from BS1, a project within a project where Neville offered short-term residencies to a number of different artists. However, it gets us off to a great start to have with us tonight Nayan Kulkarni, designer of the Cabot Circus Glazed Roof. Nayan's a multimedia artist who works often with notions of place and experimental placemaking. He often works alongside urban regeneration and in conjunction with designers and architects, and has a body of work looking at subject-object relations and the viewing of places and landscapes. With him is Keith Mackinson from Chapman Taylor Architects, who is one of the men involved in working with Nayan from the beginning of the project as director of the design architecture team. My name's James Dixon. I'm here as an archaeologist, and it might be useful to explain why. I'm currently in my third year of PhD research in creative arts at UWE, and over the last 2 years, my work's focused on the public art scheme of the Cabot Circus development. Central to my work is the event of urban regeneration itself and different approaches and reactions to this. I do the kind of archaeology that aims to look archaeologically at today and the world around us. Urban regeneration is always a time of change, and how people deal with this change is of great interest. Sometimes, as with Cabot Circus, the change is wholesale, with large-scale demolition and redesign of a whole area of town. At other times, it will involve reuse of existing material. My work focuses on using archaeology to build up a picture of how people deal with change in contemporary Bristol. Different groups of people claim ownership of places and spaces in different ways and for different reasons. Sometimes they erase and rebuild, sometimes they reuse, and at other times they try to do their best to do nothing at all in the face of pressure from all sides. Art and design fit into this research in two complementary ways. Firstly, a project like that at Cabot Circus, featuring around 20 artists at different stages of the development, can say a lot about how a developer is approaching a particular place, whether this is through locally or historically referential works, or through the very reasons for commissioning public art in the first place. The afterlives of art are important here, as the meaning and importance of art changes over time. Take, for instance, the Castle Park project, a large public art commission in the early 90s installed throughout Castle Park here in Bristol as part of a major refurbishment. With some notable exceptions, this public art scheme has been forgotten and lies broken, in parts literally rotting. On the flip side is the work of Banksy, technically graffiti and vandalism, but now incorporated into development plans and in parts of the country protected from removal altogether. Secondly, and with urban design in mind in particular, archaeology is especially good at looking at how the uses of things change over time. Many of the oddest parts of Bristol are so because they're failed components of a citywide modernist development programme in the mid-1960s, for example. Unfinished, and without the completion of their unifying vision, they're islands of strangeness that encourage uses far from those originally meant. Now, to give you a bit of historical context to Cabot Circus, from the mid-17th century onwards, shopping in Bristol was centred around what's now Castle Park, following orders from Cromwell to demolish Bristol Castle and create a shopping centre. So, possibly one of the earliest purpose-built shopping centres in the world. This lasted until the Second World War, when in November 1940 and January 1941, bombing raids reduced much of Bristol's shopping core to rubble. After initial plans to rebuild this historic centre, Bristol City Council, prompted by some of the country's larger chain stores, moved the shopping centre a short distance to the flat ground at Broadmead, where they constructed an almost modernist shopping centre, most of which you can still see today. This went through various alterations, including the opening of the Galleries indoor shopping mall in 1993, but by the late 1990s had declined to a point where it was decided something needed to be done. This was spurred on in no small way by the opening of Broadmead's main competition, the mall at Cribbs Causeway in 1998. Initial plans to revamp Broadmead included, coincidentally, to construct a roof over the pedestrianised parts. The improvement of Broadmead is still ongoing, but in, I think, the early years of this century, the Bristol Alliance was formed to construct Cabot Circus on the edge of Broadmead, and slightly overlapping into it, and to redesign Quakers Friars. I was at the opening last Thursday, as I'm sure other people here were, and it was very impressive, although very odd to be walking around a complete new area of town after 2 years of it being behind hoardings. So perhaps when it comes to the questions at the end, I'll be able to ask some questions more directed to these wider context of that work, and I encourage you to do the same. Moving back to this evening, as I said at the beginning, we're lucky to have with us artist Nayan Kulkarni, designer of the roof for Cabot Circus, and Keith Mackinson from Chapman Taylor Architects. I'm especially interested in networks, and the story of the Cabot Circus roof is a great example involving long-running collaboration between Nayan and Keith and his team, but also constant consultation with Bristol City Council. Not only is Nayan's roof the largest and most prominent contribution to the Cabot Circus art scheme, but the relationships developed through Nayan's work and the partnerships this created are what led to general belief in the possibility of commissioning such a large programme as that which we will be discussing over the coming weeks. With that, I'm going to hand over to Nayan and Keith, who are going to take us through the process of the creation of the Cabot Circus glazed roof. Nayan.
Well, I guess it's the first time that Keith and I've sat down in, with this many people listening to us, so this is an unusual situation for us both. And we're talking on the train, it seemed the best way to do it was just to tell the story. Credit. I thought it'd be just important as this was so embedded in the project that the credits are about, this is the first layer of people that were involved that I met and talked to on a kind of daily, monthly or weekly or yearly basis. And they're in alphabetical order at the top rather than any kind of structural formal hierarchy. But of course, underneath that layer of people are hundreds of other people that were all delivering the project, the roof in particular. However, we started off with, for those who didn't come right at the end, I was showing a twin channel video work, which was, I guess you'd call that, at the private end of the spectrum of my practice, and was the piece that one of the pieces I showed at a competitive interview, which Keith was one of the members of the interviewing panel, and that was part of the proposal, I guess, for being involved in a commission without brief. And when Sam Wilkinson, who's over there from Insight Art, rang up, it was very short notice, but it was the first time, it was a long time ago, but it was the first time I'd ever been given the opportunity to be interviewed with that much openness. So my experience at that point had always been a case of an artist either rejecting the brief altogether, i.e. not applying because it was very constraining, or trying to find out strategies of expanding the thinking of the brief. In this brief, it was the opposite. Job was really, there's no brief particularly apart from to participate. So in fact, the job was to constrain and bring in a brief and to find a place with what turned out to be an enormous team of people. That was back in March 2003, I believe. And Keith's team had produced a basic master plan for the central space in Bristol.
Yes. Well, at the interviews, which I remember quite well, particularly for some curious reason, remember the swinging tassels. But what we were after at that meeting, we felt Nayan fulfilled it in the way he talked and presented himself, was someone that would work with us in the actual fabric of the building, the design of the building, I felt always strongly that having worked with a lot of sculptors and so on over a long career, they always wanted to separate themselves and put themselves, I remember Liz Frink and Michael Sandel in particular, they're all wonderful pieces of work, but they would not belong to the building. They were separate from the building, and we desperately wanted to work with someone that would work with us. And we thought Nyan was the chap, and it turned out to be very right and true.
It was kind of a curious thing, though, because the Land Securities building within which the interview was held is a very intimidating space.
Is it?
Well, for me it was, anyway. Yeah. For you, you go all the time. But it's fairly secure, fairly posh, I would say, place on the Strand.
Mm.
And in the waiting area, because I think I was second or third, they had a video of all the work they were doing across the world. You probably didn't have a chance to see that. But the idea of a master plan transforming, particularly the Thames Gateway, was played at you at full volume while you're waiting to go into... have an interview about a smaller part of their work. It was quite an interesting thing.
I don't think that was coordinated.
No, it wasn't. It was just a reception.
Just to mention the basic master plan, that was primarily a product of Chapman Taylor's feasibility group, in the sense of Chapman Taylor, despite some criticisms, is probably extremely, well, one of the best people for creating a maximum amount of space out of a piece of land by the manipulation of levels. And I think, and we had that manipulation expressed in the master plan at that time. So we had the three levels.
So?
Yes, so the primary problem in such a large scheme is to, as we saw it then and still do, see it on other jobs, as particularly at that time. We had just been finished the design of Exeter, which was one of the first schemes to address the what is known as the CABE agenda, which Commission for Architecture and the Built Environments propagated the view, and many of us agreed to it, and many of us were part of developing the view, that we must return to we must regain the streets, as the phrase goes. We wanted city blocks again, we want streets again, we want public spaces again. Bristol needs those spaces again. We need the centre of the city to come alive again, because central Bristol was dying. Cribbs Causeway was helping to kill it off. So the primary aim was to get these streets and spaces back. And now, trying to do that with a commercial brief for maximising retail space and maximum rent. A glazed roof helps all of those things. It also helps those people that don't like to walk about in wet and windy conditions. But as soon as you put a glazed roof on streets and spaces, you begin to... It's the first step to the shopping centre, to the mall. So the problem set, essentially, the concept... was how do we put a glazed roof on and still keep the feeling of streets and spaces that are open day and night. And so that was really the problem for Nyan as well.
Well, that was kind of like the question of really our first work together. Mm. And I mean, I'll put these in because I didn't know that Keystein had been involved in the Bullring. I saw it going up, and my experience and understanding of shopping centres...
We're not the designers of no.
You're involved, weren't you? That's right. But this is my understanding of contemporary shopping and architecture, which is the Bullring development in Birmingham. I used to live in Birmingham. So this is kind of what I expected to be having to deal with. So the first day on the job was quite a surprise.
Yeah, we see these as now as very internal spaces, very mall-like spaces, not street spaces, not spaces that ordinary people will pass through. They're places you just go to shop in. And the another primary principle from the set in the sort of cave agenda, I use the phrase again, is to use to get variety within the development as a whole by using different architects. And again, the first time we tried this at Exeter, working with Panda Hudspeth and Wilkinson Eyre and someone else. And we created a variety of buildings and a much greater level of architectural texture and detail. And so in Bristol, we set about to do the same thing. And we have Stanton Williams on the main departments, or Wilkinson Eyre again on the car park. And we divided our team quite strictly so that each block, and there were five blocks, was done by a separate architect to actually try and speed up time, so to speak, that each of these blocks are designed separately. I was, as Nyan says, a sort of, called me a conductor of voices, which I never quite understood, but anyway, it's my job to somehow keep these people together and producing one scheme and producing the design, a coherent total design. But it's the use of different people, the use of different details, designs, to create this much greater level of complexity and texture in the urban scene. And the roof the problem for the design of the roof was to maintain that sense of separate buildings and to still exist without turning it into one mall or one development or one shopping centre.
Dodgy word though, externality, but I find that really perplexing. I mean, those ideas and agendas were being discussed way before I walked into the room, but basically my first day on the job was at City Airport, because the interview was coinciding with the broader development team's research trip to see glazed roof structures in Berlin, Stuttgart, Milan. Quite a nice gig, really. But it also meant that unusually I was meeting senior level members of the team informally, which that's really difficult to arrange, to get that many men into a room having quite often beers, but also coffees, first thing in the morning, lunchtime and evening, rather than meeting people around formal tables and hearing what the meetings are general. I just need to get to meet people. But what I was introduced to over the period of 3.5 days were a series of sometimes public, sometimes private, sometimes in between spaces that dealt with externality building and glazed roof structures.
The initial assumption when we were choosing these places to view was that the likely solution would be something that was much lighter than previous attempts at glazing spaces. So we set out to look primarily at the shell roof type of roof structure. So most of these are shell roofs. Not all.
So London, Covent Garden. That's what I go to actually every week. So this is just around the corner from my studio. Actually, Hayes Galleria in near London Bridge. Potsdamer Platz in March is freezing cold. This is the Sony Centre. The public space, the quasi-public space underneath this building, is about 7 or 8 stories. It's a massive cavern. Rogers, 3 levels of shopping, an internal street. This is Miro's Berlin Railway Station. Incomplete at the time, you can see there's a gap in the middle. I don't know if that's been filled in since we were there. What I didn't know on this trip was that we were on this journey to Stuttgart to meet the design engineer of many of these, many of the projects we're looking at. So this is Gehry's DG Bank in Berlin. Other photographs of this would show you it to be a very hermetic space, but the roof form performs tricks, and actually in plan form it tries to perform metaphor in the form of a fish. I'm not when I saw this building, I was very excited to get to a private space, a Gary space. Couldn't work out the relationship between the idea of a fish or a boat and a bank. But there was a shell kind of buried in this space as well. This was the History Museum in Berlin. Quite a hermetic space, but once again, external elevations. And I mean, I was being taught this language by these guys when I was there. I mean, they were talking about blind elevations, active frontage, external, internal building. I hadn't really thought about buildings in those terms. So actually, when you're walking around other people's projects with architects, then the way they're talking about them is an education. This is the hippo enclosure in Berlin Zoo. And this was the one that changed my idea, changed the next 6 years of my life, really, because this is Bosch Areal in Stuttgart, and it was a surprise.
Yes, these are all existing buildings, and the use of the buildings had changed, or they wanted to turn them into something other than they were first designed for, and they wanted to, it was turned into a small bijou shopping centre, I think.
Mm.
And they didn't. They wanted to respect the existing buildings, and so they articulated and separated the glazed roof and adjusted that the roof adjusts to suit the buildings around it. So whatever problem of doorway or windows or whatever, it just changes its shape to suit the existing buildings. And this was hugely exciting because it appeared to solve the problem that we had of trying to make the streets feel like streets and still provide a glass roof.
I was really struck because of all the stuff that, all of the discussions that when I was an undergraduate about Bachelard, and there's all the stuff when you're an undergraduate in sculpture, talk about Gaston Bachelard, but you basically come back at the end of each seminar to this notion of the inside and outside of an object, what's internal space, what's external space, and air, light, structure. So all the kind of formal language of sculpture that was basically underpinned my undergraduate study suddenly was at play in this quite small space in Stuttgart. That evening, we get to meet Dr. Hans Schober, who's credited, who's the kind of design engineer from Klaus Bergmann, who designed this structure and a number of the others you've seen. And the way he talked about engineering and building was he valued skill, precision, and thinking above all things. So quite a lot of his introduction to the practice was about looking at superlight structures being more than aesthetic things, which of course they are. He talked about the filigree work of engineering, but he took the whole practice philosophy of engineering encompassed a lot more more values in relation to building and skill and place and sensitivity. So obviously they're working to set briefs, but I think that there's a kind of philosophy which I was unexpected. This is old-style shopping down as well as it can be, really. Gallery in Milan, which is just quite an extraordinary space. It's unashamedly what it is, but there was quite a number of people's favourites on the trip.
Well, it's just wonderful, isn't it?
And then this very strange space just outside of, God, I can't remember what it is now. Got the notes. Renzo Piano. A glazed roof structure that seemed to stop the space being functional. It's very elegant, but it started to make, it kind of killed the space somehow.
Very strange.
So, at the time of this kind of tour around Europe, I'd been thinking about cinema in the city a lot and how cinema informs the way you understand the city and how it warps and distorts understandings. In fact, in many senses, it now seems to inform, precede the formation of a city. And I've been interested in this idea of morphing and distorting architecture. So this is Future Systems Selfridges taken to an extreme in a photographic morph. But on the bus journey back from Piano's building, I tried to understand the idea of an active edge and an open face, This is a later sketch, but essentially I was just trying to understand what people were telling me about the development in Bristol, i.e. there would be a shop front, which is open, and then a bit above the shop front, which is the back of shop, which is closed. So the red line is a roof that opens up to the shop front. So on your left is a mezzanine shop, and on your right is a non-mezzanine shop. So I was just thinking about how you could take a journey from left to right down a street. My other complete agreement with Keith on the nature of the hermeticness of a shopping centre was the front door. I think it's been called other things. But one thing that occurred to me was that if you could bring the front door right into the middle of the spaces, you would cease to have an interruption in the street experience. So, once again, to your left, that would be Old Broadmead, and I was just thinking about how you'd draw a line that would bring the front door to the pedestrian bridges in the centre of the space. Because during these 3 days, people had described the master plan, and this is kind of what I understood it to be. And then basically a street with a roof over the top, red line being roof. So I think this is after about 3 weeks of workshops at, because obviously we had to meet seven architects at tables and meet people. And I was trying to figure out a way of explaining, mostly to Scott Drayton, who was the architect I was working with most closely on this, the idea of the relationship between the roof and the streets. Obviously I didn't draw the buildings. But these were the early sketches that were presented at workshop just around the corner to the planners, and they kind of explain that drawing in 3D where the bridges become the door, and there's a separate element that covers those and allows different kinds of framings. I think it's less apparent when you're actually in there, but if you look at this sketch, I'm going to stand up. Anyway, I can't point that high. The two C shapes are bridges. If you're on the top bridge, if you look right left, you're looking through both spaces through glass, so you're notionally on the inside. So speak up. If you're on the top bridge, you're looking up and down a street, or down a street and through into public space through glass, so you're notionally on the inside of a building. On the lower level bridge, you're looking through glass down a street, so you're notionally still either inside or outside, and looking into the central space, you're looking through air. And it seems that the junction at these bridges provided these multiple viewing opportunities of looking at streets above and below them, through glass, through air, so that the northwest, the east-west axis through the development, you could constantly see it from different kinds of notions of externality.
It was very important to be able to see the top of it as well as being underneath it. It was a further device for emphasising the role of this roof as a free spirit, so to speak, that was separate from the buildings. So you were looking at it in different ways, in different places.
And it was in the streets.
And it was in the streets.
Yeah. I think it's worth, if you look through the sketches as we show them, the blue line showing the top of the building changes in position, and that's perhaps when we can talk about that in the questions. So the team, this is Scott Drayton. It's the only photograph I've got of him. Took that on last Thursday. In terms of collaboration, there has to be a kind of a generosity, and I'm not sure how generous I was, but Scotty was extraordinarily generous because he was tasked with working with the roof. And the conversation was never one of ownership. He had to give up something to allow us to have a conversation. And I guess for 2 years, Scotty and I were working pretty intensively on and off and trying to establish the principles and explain them to the rest of the team and the development team. This is a sketch of the black model is Scotty working with the five or six architects in Chapman Taylor, establishing what their buildings are doing. And then the colored mesh drawings are Scotty and I working together on trying to make the roofs work within that context. So it's very abstract. It's an almost impossible thing to understand as a drawing, because the minute you take it away from the buildings, it becomes almost impossible to understand. So Scotty and I understood these, and one of the problems and challenges of the project was communicating what these abstract forms meant in concrete reality. So we put a bridge in. Part of the task was also to look at the bridges, and you'll see these how the procurement process has changed what the bridge proposals were to what one has on the site. So these allowed light, you couldn't see through the bricks, but they allowed light to travel through them. This was the end of stage D. Is that planning? This is the planning submission drawing, which was a kind of integrated concept sketch for the roof and the bridges. Attempted to sum it up in this animation. The white buildings are the edges of the buildings, so I've had to dissolve them. It's only 6 seconds long.
A long 6 seconds.
It is, isn't it? So it's an attempt to explain something about how it worked in relation to the architecture. So that was Chapman Taylor, myself, and Schleich Bergman and Partners. It goes. It was then taken over by design and build process, which
procurement process. Yeah, the. Sir Robert McAlpine was successful in tendering for construction, and with modern design and build systems, procurement methods, they also become the architects in effect and employ their own. And Benoist was the architects they worked with during the construction process.
So the engineer changed, the technology changed, and the team one's working with changed. In fact, it just got bigger. There were like 16 to 20 people in a meeting rather than the 6 or 7. But the main liaison was with Jonathan Bethel, who's the executive architect from Chapman Taylor. And essentially, he had to champion the roof for 3 years with the whole construction management. And also a new engineering team, SKM Hunts, led up by Timothy Rowe. And that was kind of the point at which the whole concept and actually its construction design was at its most fragile. So this was the last drawing that was issued to McAlpine's. And then over the next couple of years, there were a series of very... I mean, this drawing does not tell you how painful that process was. The transition from left to right was 6.5 months' work, and an enormous amount of quite heated debate. And essentially, it's a closed and an open street, an ugly and a graceful structure. And these drawings were all intended to explain to the people we were working with the difference between a thing that does that and a thing that does that. And I think ultimately the argument for that was one because this got bored with us. It can't be because they're very against, but the very, very small differences to, these drawings don't tend to explain the story. And then there's a group of people that have to understand that, and I can't understand that. So then they're broken down and simplified into elements. And then somebody has to transpose that thing floating in a hypothetical space into real space. And that was the last, this is the last drawing that I did on the project. The blue line being the art line. Any other line was a line that was post the artist and post a collaboration. So the model that came out of those blue lines is the one I'm going to show you. I'll just let this one swing. And I think in terms of the process of collaboration, this is where it stopped, because the engineering design was fixed. We'd worked very, very successfully in Timothy Rowe's team from SKM Hunts. And then really they started to build it, and that's at that point you kind of have to you're kind of, in some ways you have to leave, but some ways you're pushed away from the site. So I made this model after, because it takes quite a long time to put the model together, trying to understand what it is that we'd agreed to build in the workshops. And at that point, the relationship between the bridges and the street roofs were kind of intact. What it does reveal as a model is how much little kinks and inflections and reveal something about the buildings it's trying to join. So. Another interesting thing that I learnt about materials is that when somebody holds a piece, a smart sample of low iron glass, that's white glass, and standard flow glass, green glass, it's very apparent to me, even more so to Susanna Heron, which one is clear. But the team was sceptical until they stood underneath two samples. It's a very big cost difference between low iron glass and standard flow glass. Mm. But it wasn't until, so they built two samples, one with low iron glass and one with green glass, and there wasn't actually an argument under a piece of roof, but there was certainly an argument with two samples in a, you know, in an office.
Yes, we were very, very keen to have clear glass. Again, just that damn fitting stuff I hate.
So you can't see the sky?
Well, it's just utterly perverse to me.
A number of these are by Paul Grundy, who's the photographer in commission to do the public art and the scheme, but not all of them. But thank you very much, Paul, for sending these. So you can actually see the roof being constructed. Whilst it's being constructed, it's almost impossible to tell what it's going to be like because you can't really see it because there's so much stuff in the way. But it is built by men on up in the air and they're welding it together. So it came on as ladders, didn't it? Curved ladders, as big as they could make them. They joined it up, strapped it in place and welded it and then painted it. Not as many people as I thought. There were two teams, I think, two teams of six. See how thin the glass is? And I was asked to comment on what I thought of the roof in that context. It's impossible to tell. But like lots of architecture, in the end, somebody goes around with a glue gun and fills all the gaps. It's a kind of a mastic seal, but there's always somebody with a tube of something making it of sticky stuff. And that was the last stage before it opened last Thursday. Perversely, this is the only building that was really altered to join with the roof, but it was quite a positive change, I think.
Yes, they had a tendency to keep pushing the roof up.
Yes. it's to do with sight line, to do with understanding sight line. And there was a very big concern that the roof would get in the way of seeing the shops. So there was a rational analysis that I think the whole team made showing sight lines, which allowed the roof to be where we put it. But there's an irrational and subjective relationship to those drawings and a fear that pushed them up. So everything's about 2.5 to 3 metres higher in the air than it might have been. Not everything, but some of them. I think South Street functions pretty much as drawn. For those who haven't seen this,
that's North Street, isn't it?
That is North Street.
Yeah.
North Street's the one with trees in it.
Or whatever it's called now, I'm not sure.
Chicken Street?
Chicken Street.
No. What's that say? It's there in the corner. I don't know where Milk Street is, but it's in Cabot Circus. I took this on the night because I thought it was really funny how non-reflective glass is, and this really proves it. Because we had all these arguments for 3 years about the relative reflectivity of glass. This is North Street again. This is South Street, which is probably the closest piece of urban design this is how I imagined the whole space to be, the whole of Cabot Circus. Complex buildings, exterior buildings, a street full of people, lots of completely different, a cultural shift left to right on that, a building that refers to almost a medieval kind of relationship, and then the building on the right to a kind of a nod to European modernism. I mean, the bricks in the original specification were actually Dutch, and there's kind of Dutch modernism in that building. And this is the thing about being on a bridge looking down into a street as if it was in a greenhouse. No roof, but it's just a, I thought it was quite a funny image. A total shopping.
They're not all ladies.
No, the Café Rouge, yes, of course. But that's kind of how I imagined it to be. There are people between surfaces in spaces that aren't shopping. Because the volumes of space in between the roofs and the bridges have no active function. I think that's about it, isn't it, really?
Yep.
Right, well, thank you very much, Pat, Nyan, and Keith. We can open that up to questions from the floor, if anybody has anything they'd like to start with.
When you say all costs, I mean the whole development, I don't know, somebody said 500 million or something. But a lot of that goes into moving motorways and in order to get the space to increase the critical mass of central Bristol so that it can compete effectively with other cities and out-of-town shopping centres. We need the space to make into shops. And so moving the road and moving the electric substations, which served most of central Bristol, including the hospital. They're hugely expensive exercises. The actual roof, I'm not sure what that...
$7.5 million.
$7.5 million. It wasn't...
Not expensive, actually.
Particularly expensive, but partly because...
In context.
Well, just compared to Bullring or something. Because one of the upsides of not making it a sealed space is that we could just have single glazing, and we could have clear glazing. We didn't have to have it fitted in order to keep the heat and vent people happy. And it's glass that costs the money. So that was that made it.
And also the one
relatively economic in comparison to other systems.
And it's naturally ventilated.
Yes, it's naturally ventilated. Yeah, I mean that may create some problems in the winter.
I mean, I noticed on the launch day they let some smoke out as an effect, and it quickly disappeared down the street and out of the development. I thought it was supposed to go out the sides, but just straight out.
Yes.
There's so many people there, just hearing
some of
the noises happening. Did you factor in the
environment? Well, we did think about it a lot. We have a report saying it won't be noisy, but and you do get some, when there's less people in there, you get some strange echoes as well. You stand in the middle of the central square, and
6 foot in front of House of Fraser's front
door. There is a spot.
There's a sweet spot.
Speak to me later, I'll tell you. At which you can get some really weird effects.
I think it's one.
No, it is noisy. It must be a product of the glass roof. Yes. Anyway. Yes, no, it must, yeah, I agree with you, yes. But we haven't really had an opportunity to examine it in its various conditions of numbers of people and circumstances and so on. Yes, it would indeed. Somebody ought to do a philosophy a degree thing on it. What do you call them?
PhD.
PhD, yes.
Was there a deliberate attempt to blur the relation between engineering structure and public art, and art as otherwise a function and art.
Yes, it is a deliberate attempt, as far as I'm concerned, anyway.
Well, I don't know about deliberate, it just happened. We didn't deliberately set out to blur any, blur the relationship between an artist, an architect and an engineer, did we?
I didn't have those words in mind, yeah. No, but I mean the notion of the public art having a functional basis was profoundly important. So in that sense, there is a blurring.
Hmm.
Sam? I'd be quite interested to know, given how much this is based around experiencing space, both in terms of the roof and its contribution, and the actual buildings themselves. I wonder what sort of contextual research you did into other Bristol spaces and their use, and how this fits into the city. In that sense,
Other than walking about and trying to understand the city, feeling the city. I've been working in Bristol from the last recession, and working with Bristol and West. And so I knew the city reasonably well. And one of the pleasures I got from the city was its variety and its texture. And I didn't really feel that the sort of utilitarian architecture of Broadmead contributed greatly to the excitement of the city or the pleasure of the city. Mm. Well, it has some qualities, but it was dull and nowhere near. It was, we used to have various images of parts of the city we always had on the wall when we were discussing the design, which expressed this wish for variety and large-scale texture, as I call it, the large-scale texture of the mill buildings and the warehouse buildings and the old Bristol, really.
Mm.
I personally get a lot of pleasure from that, and certainly the planners were also of the same mind. But it was no formal research in that sense, mm. other than 45 years at it, I suppose.
Yeah. Okay.
So is it a roof which happens to have been designed by an artist who's had a go at being an architect, or is it an artwork that happens also to be a roof? If it's an artwork, I mean, presumably it has, you've tried to imbue it with some meaning other than the purely practical. And if so, what kind of meanings were you, were you trying to imbue it with some meaning other than the functional and the commercial?
I wouldn't suggest that one would imbue an art object with meaning. I think they either do or they don't have meaning. But I think in terms of... I couldn't imbue an object with meaning. I don't have that kind of deity power. But I think one of the things I've been interested in is the notion of experiential placemaking, how that works. That's separate to this commission. That's just something that I'm interested in. And the idea of functional space, well, then one should have a look and see how much of inaccessible, unfunctional space there is in the structure. I'm quite surprised it's been built, actually, because of the amount of inaccessible, non-functioning spaces there are. And I think I wouldn't claim it to be an art object, but I wouldn't claim that was what I was commissioned to do. It's a piece of thinking which is a person that was making performance for videos, meeting a design team and thinking about shopping. Now, I think one of the ironies of this process for me is I think I like shopping more than most of the people I was working with. And actually, Norman Hingston liked shopping as well, who's one of the land securities guys. I was very surprised by how many architects, not just at Chapman Taylor, but architects involved in retail, they don't actually like shopping that much. It's the job they do, they design shops. I like shopping. I'm disappointed by how small the men's department is in Harvey Nicks. Very disappointing for me. I've done this commission, I could afford some trousers now. But I think that the idea of how you, how an individual is involved in creative practice can contribute to public space is one of the roles of an artist. Whether or not there is an art object that has an art, has a conceptual critique, I'm trying to paraphrase too much here, it wasn't a worry. I haven't never really worried about that. But I have worried about it since I've been asked it quite a bit. I mean, one of the architects challenged me on day one, you're an artist who just wants to be an architect. And other lectures I've done on this, it's like, well, I don't see any art, I just see architecture. And actually, I think it's kind of irrelevant. It was actually a piece of thinking that informed the way these street spaces are experienced, for good or for bad. If I hadn't, I really, really got into what Keith was saying about streets. If I hadn't, something else would have happened. If I disagreed with Keith's principles, there might have been a complete, I probably would have left after a 2 month period of research and provocation. I spent quite a lot of time in the Colonial Museum here. It was a Commonwealth Museum. But we did agree on some things.
Yeah, I think the ambiguity between art and architecture it proves that it's successful. I didn't want an iconic piece of art, personally.
Could I ask why you wanted a roof in the first place?
It's there is a desire amongst the voters, people of Bristol, to have, when consulted, to have a glass, have a roof, either rain off. The other reason, which is also a powerful one, is the value of the shops from rental terms, so I'm told by letting agents, goes up to get more money, the shops that have a glass roof. Over the street. In the main, it's cleaned by the rain, but you get up there and walk about on it with a broom or a brush or cloth. Main is collected at various hoppers and rainwater pipes.
Sorry?
It's collected a gutter going round the perimeter and goes into various hoppers. This was particularly initial design. It always had gutters, but we were letting the water come through at the sides. But this was thought to be too perverse. I would still like to have seen it completely separate, but anyway. And it's collected in the gutters, and there's various overlaps where you get a big gap. I don't know if there's a detail of some of the overlaps, but
there's an overlap.
An overlap. Yeah.
That's
sorry. The lead projecting roof. with various devices to create overlaps of the gaps. But I'm fairly certain that in certain weather conditions there will be drips. And there is one particular cascade at the moment which is being addressed. Yes, there was, yeah. No, thankfully we actually face against the southwest wind just by good fortune. And the thing in the main, although it's got openings, acts almost like a bottle with, you can't, there's not enough openings to create a rush of air through it. So you blow into it and the air's coming back at you. I mean, that's oversimplifying it, but. Sorry, I can't quite hear what you're saying. I've heard of it, yeah, but I've not seen it or.
You haven't saw any of the images
or
any inspiration?
I don't think so, no.
Did you think about looking at the wider context of trying to bring in the Yorkville?
Yes, no, there have been many strategic studies of doing that, and I'm sure the old broadmeat will come in. There are many, although the current climate may put a stop to it for the minute, but I'm sure in a few years' time it will spread. I missed the beginning of what you said, actually,
I'm
sorry.
I'm interested in the fact that you've had such a big brief and that NAM was brought in at such an early stage in the concept development.
Yes.
I'm just wondering if you'll continue to work in that way and how you'd advocate to other developers and architects to also adopt the same sort of
method. Yeah, no, it's wonderful, but primarily because Land Securities, who were our client at that time, or at least the driving client, it was Hammerson's hadn't come into the sort of management of the scheme at that time. But Land Securities have a inbuilt culture. They are great patrons of the arts. I mean, it's just a wonderful thing to work with them because, you know, they're not nasty developers. They are trying desperately hard to do the right thing. And I think Exeter is a lovely example of their patronage, both in architecture and art. If we have more clients like that, my goodness, it would be great.
We had a question at the back.
Well, history of shopping through recessions, I've been through quite a few recessions, three I think. There will be a downturn, people shop less, but there will be an upturn. I mean, unless there's something really strange happens, I don't see a problem at all. There will be a demand. Cabot Circus will prove to be successful and they will wish to expand it. I'm absolutely 100% certain of that.
Well, the chief exec of Hammerson's is very clear about that.
And the people like Hammerson's and Land Securities don't particularly take much notice of recessions. They keep on ploughing on because they just have a long-term view. If you respond, on average, it takes 10 years to develop a piece of city centre to go through all the process.
Yeah,
and you can't stop and start, you just got to keep going.
I just completely am on this morning, so I'm just thinking.
Yeah, yeah.
There was something up at the back there. Sorry, you were.
Why do you want to take the commission?
So I didn't know that at all.
Why do you want to take it on?
I thought I'd answered that, but because
look
at the long answer. There's a thing about public spaces where you, I think, not as an artist as such, but as a person involved in pontificating or procrastinating about the emancipation of public space, I needed to learn about the kind of people, how people were actually making the space as I was inhabiting it. And my practice involves working in community consultation work, developing collaborative designs for streets in very low scale, low key spaces. And this was an opportunity to actually learn how a space of this kind was made. Because as I walk around London now that I live there, I'm perplexed by the brass dot syndrome of public realm. Some of you might be aware of a line of brass dots along town squares where one place is public and one place is private. And this became very apparent when I was working with a group of students in Birmingham, where we were putting temporary works into public spaces, where some students were being moved on because they were in private spaces and the rest of the students were working quite happily because they were in public spaces. And I'm kind of interested in those processes, but I'm also interested in form. And I guess the form was just an accident of the commission, but the reason to apply was to be involved in forming a part of a city. And I figured when I got the phone call, I wasn't going to get that opportunity many times in my career to be involved in forming a part of the city. So it's kind of megalomaniac as well, I guess, but it's also about testing some of the more left-wing aspects of my education. I'm not suggesting that they've retained particularly, meeting face-to-face the people that change our cities, because there aren't many men doing it. There aren't many men who are buying public space, and there aren't many men who are making those decisions. There were a few, but the people making the critical decisions above the design level were chief executives who fulfill the profile of a senior executive of a multinational PLC company. Ultimately, they're making decisions about public space, and I wanted to get close to them. Not to take their money, but to understand how they work.
We can probably take one more question.
Has changed anything in your work?
Yeah. It changes everything, doesn't it? You doubt. It's very easy. Well, I was quite young when we started this, wasn't I? Quite a lot younger. Early 30s, now like I'm 40s, yeah. Yeah, I mean, because you're challenged, you're meeting people that you fundamentally disagreed with as a kind of philosophical or political. It's quite easy in an art school context as a lecturer to debate cinema and the city and debate the ownership of space. But it's less easy to hold on to those views when you've spent 6 years arguing and learning that when you've lost arguments, that there's a good reason, because your argument wasn't as strong, wasn't as informed, wasn't as sensitive as you thought you were. So yeah, I've learned a lot, and I've also learned not to trust my eyes in relation to architecture and the urban environment. Things are not what they seem to be. But I learned that simultaneously in working in Piper Close, when what appeared to be a scrubland was in fact a sacred football pitch. And that's not to do with land securities, that's to do with just boys playing and people wanting to build a home zone and understanding the value of that piece of scrubland. And those two things happen simultaneously.
Okay, I think that's a good and important point to end on, really, that not only does having artists involved from early stages affect built spaces, but also artists getting involved in projects like this can actually change artistic processes and take art forward. I've just got some short announcements I've been given. The first is just to remind you that this series of lectures carries on for another 3 weeks. The Arnolfini is very grateful to Insight Arts, Bristol City Council, and Bristol Alliance for their support of this series. And BCC will be continuing that support next year with future lecture series about other public art projects and issues that affect public realm in Bristol. And also to remind you that next week's talk is from Timorous Beasties rather than Neville Gaby, but Neville Gaby will be here the week after that. We can carry on talking in the bar next door, but before we do that, can you join me in thanking Nyan and Keith for an interesting evening?